God gives you purpose. I believe my purpose in life is to ensure that no child goes hungry and to support the eradication of malnutrition across the world.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, Conversations and Life Lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. Healthy organic food is an integral part of the ranch lifestyle. Sadly, so many people on our planet do not have access to healthy food. My guest today is the former executive director of the World Food Program. Her name is Earthrin Cousin. Earthrin continues to educate and look for solutions to the staggering statistic that over 3 billion people on this planet, 47 million here in the United States, don't have access to healthy food. When I met Earthrin at the ranch a few months ago, I knew I wanted to interview her and help spread her message.
I do want to ask you right off the bat, your name, Earthrin, it's such an unusual name. Where does that come from?
My mother thinks she's creative. And let's just say my mother is creative.
She is creative.
And her name is Annie. And okay. She was determined that her children would never have common names. And our names are Earthrin, Tibra, Yvette, and Zena. And we're also in alphabetical order by birth. So I'm the oldest, and it goes from E to Z.
That is awesome. So there's no particular meaning to your name.
There's no particular meaning.
Okay, well, it's awesome. Everyone remembers, I'm sure.
Yes.
So you were the executive director of the United Nations World Food Program from 2012 to 2017. Mm-hmm. So what is the mission of that program?
The United Nations World Food Program's mission is to provide the food assistance that is necessary to support the planet's most vulnerable people. That is our overarching mission. That work included humanitarian emergency support, as well as providing food assistance in protracted crisis, those situations where hunger is created by droughts and floods, as well as those situations where hunger is created by war. But just as importantly is the development work that the World Food Program provides. And that is providing the seeds and tools and assistance alongside other organizations to assist in the ability of vulnerable people to feed themselves. The tagline, for lack of a better term, is saving lives and changing lives is the work of the World Food Program.
It sounds like an overwhelming task.
Well, when I was there, the program was, we raised about $7 billion a year, and we fed about 85 million people in some 80 countries around the world. Because of climate conflict and the COVID and the after effects of COVID, the organization is now feeding over 113 million people a year, and the budget is closer to $11 billion per year.
That's pretty crazy. And it's wonderful. I've watched many of your interviews now, and I watched one of your TED Talks. And I have to tell you, the thing that impresses me the most about you is your passion. You are so passionate. And I love passionate people. And you're passionate about food. Mm-hmm. And so tell me, where does that come from? Because I know you're a lawyer by trade.
I'm a lawyer by training. God gives you purpose. And mm-hmm. I believe my purpose in life is to ensure that no child goes hungry and to support the eradication of malnutrition across the globe. And I believe that with every molecule in my body. And so you cannot believe in this work and not express it through how I communicate, how I approach the work. And I am a passionate person, and I have taken that passion and focused it on my purpose.
How does one become assigned the CEO director? And is it a set time? Because I saw you did it for
5 years. I was nominated At the time that I became the executive director of the World Food Program, I was serving as the U.S. ambassador for food and agriculture, which meant that I represented the American people to all of the food agencies around the globe, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, the International Fund for Agricultural Development. I served as a liaison for the taxpayer dollars that were invested in those programs. When the decision was being made about who would become the next executive director of the World Food Program, the then Secretary of State Clinton and President Obama, after interviewing a number of candidates, offered me the opportunity for them to put my name forward to the Secretary General of the United Nations. Because this is a United Nations post, the selection process includes the Secretary General and the Executive Director of the Food and Agriculture Organization. And the Secretary General having the final decision-making authority. I met with the Secretary General, who was then Ban Ki-moon, and what was supposed to have been a 15-minute conversation was an hour long. And afterwards, he then called the U.S. representative to the United Nations at the time, who was Susan Rice. She's our candidate. I'm impressed. She will do a great job. And so he then appointed me to the post, which is a 5-year term. And so I served from 2012 to 2017.
And so what are you doing now? I'm sure you're still involved.
Oh, my goodness. I am doing everything I can now. When I left the World Food Program, Stanford University offered me the opportunity to come and teach and write and think for 2 years. And so I served as the Payne Distinguished Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute. And I taught there. I taught a course on humanitarian response during conflicts. But most importantly, I wrote and did research and began to look at the question of what would it take for us to develop a market-based system that would make food more affordable and available. And Rockefeller gave me a grant, BCG gave me people, and Stanford University gave me students to explore the answer to this question. And out of our research came the hypothesis that if we could invest in businesses that could scale to support the access to affordable, nutritious food, that we could begin to make a food system that was not only resilient to environment, but also begin to have a food system that supported human health, because it would make food and ensure that we not just have food for the affluent, but food for those who do not have the resources to today afford a diverse and nutritious diet. So coming out of that, we created this organization called Food Systems for the Future. And we have a nonprofit organization and a for-profit fund that work together. And the nonprofit organization focuses on the partnerships, the policy, the advocacy, the research, and providing the operational support that's necessary to help businesses scale, but to also create the macro ecosystem that is necessary for food and agriculture businesses from farmer to fork to thrive and grow and to work in, and that takes a lot of different dimensions. But we also know that without capital, partnerships, advocacy, none of that's going to matter. Mm-hmm. And so we are ambitious enough to also start a fund. And we have just begun our raise for our first Food is Health Fund to invest in those businesses, particularly and it is not philanthropy and it is not your typical VC fund. It is a fund that is that will invest in businesses that are in that messy middle where, or that missing middle, shall I say, the missing middle where they're beyond seed, but they're not yet at the point where they're developed, that where they're generating a profit. They're generating revenue, but not a profit. And so they need the capital to help them through that period to grow to the point where they can generate profit. They need that support that the Institute can provide. And so that is the work that we are doing. And I'm blessed to have on the fund side, finance people. The former president of Rabobank USA is the chair of our investment committee. I have two other partners on that, in that business, that are finance executives. One of them has been in food investing for the last 15 years, and the other one's been in PE and venture investing for the last 25. And so they know money. And so when we go out to raise the capital that is necessary, we can say to potential investors, this is not charity. This is an opportunity for you to receive a market rate return on investment while also helping ensure that we make food more affordable and available.
Have you been well received, do you think, overall?
We launched the fund January 7th when I came back from my time at the ranch. And within 1 week, we had our first investor commit to $500,000. So we're working to raise a $60 million fund. And so this was an investor who has followed our work for some time and said he wanted to give us the momentum that we needed to move forward. And it's exciting to have a vision that is recognized by those who can make that vision a reality.
So is your organization based in the United States, and are there similar organizations around the world?
Yes, we are based in the United States. The nonprofit works globally. Mm-hmm. And the for-profit fund is a U.S. domestic fund. And it is only raising capital for the United States. And some people would say, why are you only raising capital for the, we need to start in the United States. Right now, 50% of Americans suffer from some form of diet-related disease. And much of that is the inability and the inaccessibility of those too many Americans to access and afford more nutritious and diverse diet. We have 45 million Americans who can't afford a diverse diet on a regular basis. And much of that is because, and some you hear often, I'm sure you've heard this, we grow enough food. The problem is we just don't grow enough food in the places where people who need it can access it. And the scientists, the experts at FAO have proven that statement wrong. We grow enough calories. Mm-hmm. When 60% of the calories that we grow are from corn, wheat, rice, and soy, but the we don't grow enough fruits, vegetables, legumes, the kind of foods that will provide that diverse diet that is necessary to support a healthy microbiome. And so that is why it is important that we perform this work starting in the United States. Yes, there are others who are focusing on scaling up businesses that can support a more sustainable food system. But what we found is that too many of the new tools that are coming online, the new foods that are coming online for the affluent, not for those who can't, who are vulnerable. And so what we want to do is shift that paradigm to ensure that what we bring online, the investments that we make food affordable and available universally.
Yeah, I've said this before, but I feel like wellness is for the wealthy sometimes, you know. Do you think it's accurate? I read somewhere that about 3 billion people can't afford a healthy meal on this planet.
That's true. Absolutely true. Let's say 3.1 billion people, and that number goes up every year.
That's 38% of the world population. That's insane. You know, I've been a DJ in the past, so I relate everything to music. But in the 80s, that huge song, Feed the World, and about trying to make. So do you think this problem has made progress, or is it still as bad as it was then?
It's a different kind of problem, I would argue, today.
Yeah.
When we were all singing the Michael Jackson Feed the World song, it was because we were addressing the challenge of a famine in Ethiopia.
Right. A very specific thing, yeah.
It was a very specific thing. And what we have seen is that we have now created a food system that provides enough calories so that we don't have mass famines. You know, when the World Food Program was started, China was experiencing famine on a cyclical basis almost every couple years. And at the time, that 50 plus years ago, the world said China would never feed itself. But because of the Green Revolution, because of investments that the Chinese government made, in India, you had the same issue because of the Green Revolution, investments that the government in agricultural production of calories, we filled stomachs. But what and my mother always says, when you know better, you do better. We were able to fill stomachs to the point where we eliminated large mass famines for the most part. We can talk about conflict and climate in a minute, but as a chronic challenge that the world was facing, we overcame that issue. But what we realized was that just calories alone is not enough.
Right.
That you also need a healthy diet that feeds the microbiome in a way that will allow for the avoidance of diet-related disease and for a healthier lifestyle. And that we haven't done yet.
Right.
That's why 3.1 billion people can eat a bowl of porridge that provides for their ability to work, but not their ability to live a long, healthy life.
Yeah,
and that's what we need to change.
Yeah, to me, it's like the difference of I go to Whole Foods and I see who's shopping there. And then I go to the dollar store and I see families buying their groceries at the dollar store. So that's such a diverse thing, you know? But it's the reality. So I'm going to focus on the positive, but I also want to ask you, do you think that the global warming and the climate issue and the growth in population are two of the biggest challenges?
Thank you for that question. What's driving acute hunger today? There are 285 million people who, without assistance, will not have the ability to feed their families anything, whether it's calories or a diverse diet. And what drives acute hunger today is climate and conflict. And as we've seen an increase in conflict and an increase in the impact of droughts and floods, we're witnessing increases in acute hunger. And so we know that is why emergency humanitarian assistance, even if while we work to create the systems that will support our ability to grow more food that is affordable and available, we must have a safety net that addresses the challenges, particularly of vulnerable populations during conflict and climate change, because it's real. And when I can tell you, I've sat with mothers who are working to grow food in places where the long rains are now short and the short rains don't come. In Somalia, you're looking at a season where they're in their sixth season of drought. And in places like that, the most vulnerable people, the poorest people, live on the most in the most are live in the most vulnerable places, and they are the ones who are first impacted by the whether it's drought or conflict.
Yeah, that makes sense. I also read some of the 25% of the greenhouse gases are produced by our own agriculture. And if that's true, do we need to start growing food in a more wise way?
Well, you are a smart man, let me just tell you. And I am loving this conversation. Yes, we need a diversity of solutions in our agricultural production, because as you know from the ranch, soil health is critical to the production of our crops and the sustainable production of our crops. And so we know that we can't continue to grow food in the way we have done it in the past. It has created soils that are micronutrient deficient. It has created 70% of the fresh water draws on an annual basis are used in our food and agriculture system. The primary driver of biodiversity loss is directly related to our increasing land under cultivation for agricultural production. We know that in the United States, we eat too much meat. We need a more diverse diet in the United States, because some 40 to 60% of the grains that we grow are used for the production of cattle, of livestock. Okay. And we know that the 25% of greenhouse gases that you talk about, that you mentioned, the driving force behind that greenhouse gas emission is livestock and how we manage our livestock today and what our cattle eats. It's the burping and the farting of our cattle. And it's not carbon, it's methane. And so methane, as you know, is much more of potent than carbon. But people say, well, it's in the environment for a shorter period of time. Okay. But during the time that it's in our environment, it has a significantly greater detrimental impact on our environment. And so all of those issues being true, we know that we must move to more regenerative agriculture. Our farmers know this, but here's the reality. Our farmers are paid and supported for here in the United States in particular, but around the world, the subsidies that farmers receive are for growing the particular crops and growing them in particular ways. If we want to change farmer production, we need to support financially our farmers' ability to change that production. Because as they move to more regenerative agriculture, there's a cost to that. And consumers, we've just talked about the number of consumers who can't afford nutritious food already. So what you don't want to do is force farmers to change production and drive those costs into consumers that already can't afford it. So we need our subsidies to support not just what our farmers grow and how much, but how they grow it. And changing those subsidies will change farmer behavior. Changing consumer demand will change farmer behavior.
Right.
And so all of that, that's why we talk about it as a food system. You can't just do one thing. You just can't invest in farmers. We need to invest in consumers as well. And awareness and knowledge on the part of consumers so that there's greater demand for more sustainably produced food. We need to invest in our production facilities so that they are providing more products that deliver the nutrition that the consumers need, as well as supporting the production of our farmers from an environmental standpoint that will change how the greenhouse gases that are produced. And that includes our livestock. I love a good steak, but should it be at the center of my plate every day? Probably not. Should it, should we continue to produce in a way that, is energy extracting and greenhouse gas emitting? Definitely not. Right. And so I've had the benefit of working with the Meat Institute and the poultry industry too, and as well as the pork industry, to talk about the changes that we must make in production and to work with them on the advocacy that is necessary to support the, again, those the subsidies that they receive for making those changes that allow for us to maintain jobs as well as to maintain the environment, to drive the environmental health and the human health that we need.
Hi, my name is Isela, and this is my first time at the ranch, and I'm super stoked to be here. My friend has been coming here for 20 years, and I finally was able to come here. And it was everything I expected. So many activities, so many sessions to go to, so many workouts, and so many spa treatments. So I've kind of been doing a little bit of everything. Also, the food is fab. I think everyone is a little scared to go completely vegetarian, but don't be afraid. All of the food is so good. They also squeeze in some treats here and there, give you some guac, some chips sometimes. But honestly, I don't even think I'm missing anything eating all the vegetarian stuff. All my back-to-back workouts have been really great. Sometimes I'm so exhausted because I have to leave the pool to go to my next workout or go get my facial or my massage. But fully recommend coming here. I need to come back again soon. But recommend it for anyone, whether you're a teenager or you're 30, 40, 50. I'm working out next to a 90-year-old man who's probably stronger than I am. So please come. Come be my neighbor. Everyone is so kind. It's such a safe space to be in. Everyone's here for the right reasons, for the same intentions. So at the end of the week, you're friends with everyone and everyone knows your name, which is super cool, but it's super cute. So I do recommend coming here.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply.
So, Earthrin, we were talking about how farming has to change. Mm-hmm. And not that we're not creating food, but we need to start to farm smarter. Mm-hmm. And you guys said there's some tools, like there's biological tools, there are digital tools. What did you mean by that?
When we talked about the Green Revolution and the change in agriculture, we increase the efficiency of agricultural production, but we increase the efficiency of agricultural production at a cost. It impacts our soils. It impacts the amount of water that we use. So we need to change. And I am not going to suggest that chemicals will not continue to be a part of some of our agricultural production. But we need a diversity of solutions. And that includes organics. It includes more, but it also includes using the tools that are necessary to support what the soil needs to produce at the maximum level while creating more sustainability in that agricultural production. That means we need more digital tools. We need tools that allow us to more precisely use chemicals. We need more biological tools. That's gene editing, seeds that allow for the production of the foods that we need using less water and less inputs. Also, new seeds that are gene edited that allow for us to provide more of the micronutrients potentially that are required for our consumption. So the tools that, and when I talk about gene editing, I am talking about CRISPR. That is the new tool that everyone talks about that we know gave us vaccines that address the pandemic. That science is safe science, and we need to follow the science in producing the new agricultural tools that will allow us to increase the production of the land already under cultivation. We cannot afford to increase the land, the land under cultivation for agriculture because of the potential detrimental impact that that has on our biodiversity. We need to ensure that we feed the planet, that that's our environment, but we also grow food in a way that feeds all of the people, the micronutrients and the nutritious diets that are necessary.
So that kind of moves into the next thing I want to talk about is the financing of something like this, because you had mentioned that, you know, a lot of the, like 60% of the food that we grow is subsidized to feed livestock. So that has to shift so that they have the money to grow smart and grow food that people can eat.
Let's break that number down even more. We know that those subsidies, 85% of those subsidies go to 15% of the farmers, which means that 85% of the farmers are not receiving enough of any subsidies from government at the level that is necessary to support their ability to produce more regeneratively. More than 60% of the people who farm today, the majority of their income does not, and in the United States, the majority of their income does not come from farming because our farmers don't make enough to live on. It's off-farm income that supports their ability to continue to farm. So we need to change our subsidies to support not just the growing of grains, but the growing of fruits, vegetables, legumes, that we need to use our subsidies to support and catalyze farmer behavior to catalyze their behavior towards more regenerative agriculture. Because there's a cost to changing how farmers produce. And if farmers will, they'll produce in the way that will allow them to meet their financial needs as well as their market needs. So that financial need we can address by changing our subsidies. That market need we need to address by building consumer awareness of and as a result, changing consumer demand for more sustainably produced foods and more nutritious foods.
Right. And that financing can't just come from the government, right? We have to tap into some private sources.
And first of all, you won't get those private sources if you don't have a market. And that's why I talk about consumers, because the what farmers will tell you, they will produce what the market will buy. And then they can finance the financiers. The money, the private sector capital will invest where there is a market. So we need to ensure that we have consumer demand for sustainably produced foods. So that's one reason that we can move finance into this space. There's another reason, though. As we look at our consumer products goods, the potato chips that we eat, the producers of those potato chips are looking for more sustainably grown products. And so they get inset credits for their scope 3 emissions by by buying from farmers who are sustainably producing, and they can drive consumer demand. That gets back to that consumer question again. Imagine if consumers said, I want to know how my potato chips are grown. How were those potatoes grown? And that's how I'll decide which bag of potato chips I will buy. And it's that kind of consumer demand that will change what CPG companies do and what they pay for. And as a result, the farmers can receive more of the income that they need for that changing of how they produce foods.
Do you feel that consumers are getting a little more that way? Because I know people like my daughter's age, like that 25 to 35 range, they seem like more, like my daughter will go to a restaurant and say, she asks before she even uses the restaurant, do you buy locally? Mm-hmm. How is it, you know, and they even where they buy their meat, they care about that too.
Well, here's the reality, my friend. What consumers say and how they spend their money is often quite different. The surveys suggest, the data suggests that consumers do want more sustainably produced foods. They do want more locally produced foods. But when they go into the grocery store, the sales receipts don't reflect that demand. And so there's a disconnect there. And we need to work to address that disconnect. Because here's the reality. When consumers are in the grocery store, particularly with inflation, food inflation, the way it is today, they're standing in an aisle and they may want to buy a product that is more sustainably grown, but oftentimes their amount of money in their wallet determines what they actually put in their basket. And so in addition to making those products available and driving that consumer demand, we must ensure that they're also affordable.
Right. So in your time, this leads into my next thing I want to talk about is your consumerism. And you had mentioned that there needs to be an awareness and a will. And those are two big ones.
There's a big old difference between awareness, which we're beginning to make changes, and particularly with, as you noted, with younger people like your daughter, my son, my grandson, who read the labels, who are much more cognizant of what it requires to support both planetary health and human health. But then we also need to change the will. And the will is about affordability. But it's also about taste. Consumers very much buy first and foremost on taste, and but the good news is that produce that is grown through regenerative agriculture, beans, they all have great taste. And so we need to again build that knowledge and that awareness from brain to stomach to move products from shelf to supermarket basket.
Yeah. And I think even the way I was looking at will, too, is even like a more like humanitarian will, too, because I think that especially in certain places, a lot of places in the United States, it's like it's not our problem. You know, it's someone else's problem, where you had mentioned that a lot of the people that are, you know, need food in the world, they're not the ones creating the climate problems that's slowing us down, keeping us from doing that.
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that question, because we've been talking about the United States a lot, but 3.1 billion people globally can't afford a diverse and nutritious diet. And some 85 million people globally are suffering from acute hunger as we speak. And that acute hunger is primarily driven by conflict and climate. And too often, as you noted, people will say that's a problem over there. That's not a problem for me. I'm worried about, as you and I've been talking about, affordability of food to buy for my family. But the reality is we can't build walls high enough to separate ourselves from those in need around the world. And we know that that hunger is a conflict driver. And we know that that hunger also, and particularly acute hunger, is often related to disease. And when it's not related to disease, it's related to movement of populations. People don't stay where they can't feed their children. And so if we, but I can tell you, no one wants to leave home for food, but they will. And so if we want to build the stability on this small planet that we all live on together, we must care about what happens over there, because food security is national security. It is about the security of the mom in Iowa or Nebraska when a mother in Sudan can't feed her children. The world is a very small place, and we must care about what happens over there as much as we care about what happens here at home.
No, I completely agree. There's one of my favorite people who is no longer on the planet is Maya Angelou, and she has some great quotes. And this quote I came across when I was getting ready to interview, and her quote is, "Human beings are more alike than they are unalike." Mm-hmm. And the minute we begin to understand just the slightest part of that, we recognize ourselves as a family.
Let me tell you, I sat with some mothers in a refugee camp in South Sudan. And though they were in the refugee camp because of conflict in their home villages, and their children were depending on the work of the World Food Program to feed their children. But those children were the cleanest babies that I saw any place on the planet, because despite the fact that they had very little, they took care of their children. And they were thankful that we were assisting them to ensure their children had enough to eat. And when I asked them, this group of mothers who had walked to feed their children, what they wanted me to tell people back in America, and they said to tell them thank you. Tell them thank you for caring about us. Tell them that we want to educate our children. We want our children to have a future. I could have been talking to a mother any place on earth, including right here in America, and I would have heard the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's
everybody
beautiful.
Everybody wants the same thing for their children and for their families. Right. And while sometimes they just need a little help.
Right. So people that are listening to the podcast, is there a couple things you could tell them they could do to make a difference, or where can they start? What's a good thing?
First of all, the caring that we just talked about, make it known. I can't tell you how many elected officials have said to me, "Earthman, my people don't care." And I had the privilege of representing the people of the United States as ambassador and telling the people of the world that I was proud to represent the people of the United States, because they do care.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the most generous people on earth. But every time we have an election, hunger and malnutrition, whether we're talking domestic or international, never makes the top five issues.
Mm-hmm.
We need to change it. We need to let them know, we let those with decision-making power know that this is an issue that is important to your listeners, to the mothers, to the fathers, to the children out there, to the people who recognize our planet is small and the opportunity to provide for prosperity for every child is one that we all demand.
This is probably a really great ending point for our little talk, but I just want to tell you that I am so grateful that we have someone like you, people like you that are so passionate and out there making a difference in the world. We just need about 2 million more Earthrins out there. So,
well, thank you. And thank you for this opportunity to talk to your listeners, because I am committed to doing this work. People ask me all the time when I'm going to retire. I said, retire from what? This is not a job for me. This is my life.
Right.
And yeah. I don't expect this to be the life of everyone that is listening to us here today. But what I do hope and what I do pray is that everyone listening to us will share their commitment to opportunity for all with not just those that they are in that they talk to on a daily basis, but every time they get an opportunity to share publicly, privately, shout it from the rooftops that we are one people on this earth. Yeah. And everyone is interdependent. And we can, if we all care, make a difference.
That's awesome. Thanks for spending this time with me. And it was so great meeting you at Rancho La Puerta. And I hope that you'll be back. And
I look forward to it. Well, give everybody their hug from me. It is my happy place. And every time I leave there refreshed and ready to go back and fight the battle yet again.
That's good. Well, anytime you need refresh, you let us know.
Thanks a lot.
I am always inspired by passionate people. Earthrin is definitely passionate. Passionate about food and passionate about making a difference. I was also encouraged to know that we can easily produce enough food to feed the population of this planet. However, we need to start producing that food in a way that is healthier for the planet. Most of the crops that are subsidized in the U.S. strip the soil of its nutrients, and over half those crops go to feed livestock, which contribute to our global warming issues. One of the aspects of the ranch that I've grown to love is that our vision statement includes promoting the wellness of our planet. Here at the ranch, we practice regenerative and biodynamic farming that rebuilds the soil and brings back biodiversity. These are concepts that Earthrin spoke about, and she hopes to educate lawmakers on these concepts. What can you do? Earthrin suggests that you let the people know that you vote for, this is important to you. This is important to our planet and our resilience in the future. I encourage you to support local farmers and agriculture that is trying to do the right thing. Until the next time, this is Barry wishing you health, daily joy, and a chance to make a difference.